We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Rebecca Halifax, the recently elected Liberal Democrat councillor for Cirencester Park. Welcome to the podcast, Rebecca.
Hello, Will.
The first question that I'd like to ask is, what made you decide to stand as a Liberal Democrat councillor?
It was a bit of a surprise to me, to be perfectly honest. I can't say that well into my 40s, I had really expected to embrace a political career, if I'm honest. But I joined the Lib Dems as a member after the referendum. I got to the point where I was just really fed up with shouting at the radio and feeling somewhat impotent, and sort of got stuck in with my local party, which was in Buckinghamshire at the time. And then sort of fast forward to a couple of years ago, I was moving house because my daughter wanted to move schools for her A-levels. And we'd settled on Cirencester as being, for a whole bunch of reasons, as being a great location for her to come to sixth form college. And so I got in touch with the local party and spoke to Joe Harris, who is pretty well known in his own right. And very, very swiftly into beating him, he suggested that I might like to consider standing for the town council, which I agreed to do, and was elected to the town council sort of 5 months after moving to the town. And just a few months after that, Joe and Paul Hodgkinson, who is the leader of the Liberal Democrat group on the county council, sort of sat me down and said, look, we're starting to look at the campaign for the upcoming county council elections for 2021. We'd really like you to consider standing. So we had a number of conversations about it, and I sort of expressed my, you know, surprise and lack of experience and, you know, so on and so forth, but agreed to do it because I like local politics, actually. My experience, although it's been pretty limited as a town councillor, has been both eye-opening and also incredibly rewarding, I would say. It's hard work, for sure, and nobody should go into it with any expectation that it's some kind of cushy number. It most certainly isn't. But what it is... of course, it's at a very small scale compared to anything that might go on in Westminster. But what it is it's real things that affect real people locally. So it's real community stuff. And, people might think it's quite funny that there's lots of discussions about, you know, bin collections. But you know what? If the bin collections are going wrong, that really affects people's daily lives. So getting it right actually matters. Mm. So that's why I agreed to go ahead.
So when you were standing for election, were there any particular issues that you wanted to make sure were at the heart of your campaign? Any issues that you saw as particularly important to the past Cirencester that you were standing in?
So there's several things that are going on locally that really matter. I mean, there is obviously the perennial that is perpetually loved by Lib Dems, which is the state of the roads. And it must be said that in and around the Cotswolds, the state of our roads is absolutely awful. And again, that might not sound like a really big deal, but actually, you know, the Cotswolds is a very rural constituency. Mm-hmm. So when you have roads that are in very, very poor condition with massive holes in them, that, you know, degrades the quality of people's tyres, causes accidents. If verges and hedges overhanging trees aren't being maintained, that actually is very dangerous. and there are accidents, visibility is obscured. Those issues really matter. So that's not just something that we like to take photographs of pointing at potholes, but it's actually really important that work is done and is done regularly and is done in a very satisfactory way, as opposed to just patching a pothole, but actually resurfacing a road or properly cutting back a series of hedgerows when they're needed. So that's one thing. Another thing is our local health services. There was lots in the media over the last couple of years about the health services in Cheltenham, which obviously is neighbouring to Cirencester because of question marks over the loss of A&E services in Cheltenham. Well, there's question marks over Cirencester Hospital and what goes on there, the services that are available there. Question marks about how the doctors' practices in and around Cirencester are going to be changed. The clinical commissioning group is looking at changing things. There's a huge new housing estate being planned and the beginnings of development just starting now, and that's going to be taking place over the next few years. That in itself is going to affect the type of services that are available in the area. So there's a great deal of concern locally about what services are going to be available and how they're going to be delivered to the local community. It's easy to say, let's just move these doctor surgeries and put them in one location because that's going to be, that's going to be hugely more efficient. Well, it might be more efficient, but that's only one perspective or one data point. If there's not actually corresponding services like transport that allows those who perhaps have mobility issues or perhaps have young children that they're trying to get to the surgery, it's not easy if you've got several miles to travel and your mobility impaired to get from one side of the town to the other if there's no transport available to you. So there's a much, much wider question to answer. Then of course there's environmental considerations. Last winter and on into the spring, we had absolutely desperate flooding in the area that affected lots and lots of householders in just the worst way. There were quite a number of householders who were not even able to be in their own homes actually over Christmas itself because of the flooding. And that wasn't just flood water, that was sewage as well that broke through from the sewage system. So there is a lot of work to be done in conjunction, obviously, with the Environment Agency, with Thames Water, to make sure that appropriate remedial works are put in place and that that people don't get affected in the same way again, or that, bearing in mind the fact that climate change is real and development has taken place since, for example, the sewerage systems were built, back in the 50s and 60s, that change has to happen to make sure that in this perfect storm of events, many more houses utilising services, much more groundwater runoff, full verges because through slashed budgets, verges and ditches haven't been cleaned so much. That it's not residents who are paying the price by being forced out of their homes because they're flooded. These are several issues that came up repeatedly on the doorstep.
Do you think that part of the shift that we've seen in terms of electoral politics in areas like Cirencester and other areas in the Cotswolds, away from the Conservatives, which has been labelled as the collapse of the blue wall, we saw it in the by-election in Chesham and Amersham. Do you think that part of the reason for that is that people in areas like your own feel that the Conservatives, who've quite often been in power for years and years and years, have neglected them and simply taken them for granted.
I don't know whether that's quite so easily the case around here. Cotswolds is quite an interesting constituency in that there is quite a lot of support for Lib Dems for local politics, but for national politics, there is a tendency towards conservative policies anyway. There's some discussion, you probably are well aware, there's some discussion about boundary changes. Mm-hmm. So it become a more interesting question to answer over the next year or so. But I think, yes, as demographics have changed, there is a gradual movement away from what has been absolutely true blue rural county voting. There are a lot of new housing developments across the county now, and those are being populated by overspill from some of the bigger cities, exodus from London, and they are not the traditional either. They're not the traditional Cotswolds voters. So perhaps over the coming years we are likely to see more of a change in the voting demographic. I would love to say that we're going to see a sweeping change, yellow brick. Of course I would love to say that, but I'm also a little bit of a cynic, and I don't think it's ever easy. You know, if you're a liberal, I don't think you ever get to think it's easy. People often vote the way that they have always voted when it comes to particularly national elections. They're more likely to reconsider for local issues.
Now, you mentioned at the start of the podcast that Brexit was a motivating factor for you joining the Liberal Democrats. Do you think that the impact of Brexit has been felt in Cirencester and in the Cotswolds? And what do you make of the actions recently of the government in relation to the to wanting to change the Northern Ireland protocol? Do you think that this demonstrates that Brexit perhaps wasn't as a great idea or as a smooth transition as perhaps the Conservatives billed it as?
You know, I find the whole thing really sad, if I'm honest. Well, the vote took place, the referendum happened, and you know, like it or don't like it, the vote went the way that it did. And, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing, of course, but I think it would have been so simple at that time to say, look, the result was really, really close. And so clearly this is a country that is, it is not a strong majority in either direction. There is a real mix of feeling here. So let's be collaborative in the way that we work. Let's try and find as much as possible a middle ground. There are, of course, extremists on both sides. And you always get that with any issue. But I think it would have been so much more sensible to try and find a way that didn't really pander to the extremists, which seems to me that the way that things have progressively gone, and now we're in a situation where I don't know, I just feel like we're in a war of attrition, really, and that there are no longer any good choices for anybody, whichever way you voted. And as far as Northern Ireland is concerned, it seems to me that we're, as a country, we're breaking promises left, right, and centre, and that's appalling. I'm by my nature a I am a globalist. I've had a career in technology, which is, as an industry, is a global industry, is a very outward looking industry, is one that is not inclined towards borders and building walls. It's one that is very collaborative by nature. And you know, I would far rather we were working with our neighbours and, you know, trying to find ways to bridge our gaps rather than almost going out of our way to cause anguish. I do wish that we were behaving, I guess, with more decorum and with more honour on the world stage.
We're going to take a short break now from the podcast with Rebecca to listen to a trailer for the Politics of Sound podcast's August episode with Tom Mayhew. We'll be back very shortly.
Do you want to see your politicians from a different angle? It's time for the Politics of Sound podcast. I believe that people's record collections can reveal a lot about them, and so every month I invite politicians and political figures to reveal their three all-time favourite albums, and in exchange, I want to know all about them and their lives, what they think, and why they think it. Joining me in the record shop this month is the star of Radio 4's Tom Mayhew is Benefit Scum. That's Tom Mayhew. So why not join me, Ian Carnegie, my guests, and the house band on the Politics of Sound podcast, out now on Global Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you think then, you mentioned your background in technology there, do you think then that that's something that the Liberal Democrats should place more emphasis on in terms of promoting new technology and encouraging the development of the tech industry in the UK?
I mean, obviously, I think that would be great. Mm. I think certainly embracing technology as a way of encouraging voter engagement is something that actually no party has really pursued properly as yet. The way to really engage with young voters, for example, seems to be, there's a really obvious correlation between tech and young people, and we're not making the most of that for sure. I believe in the ideal of democracy for sure, and for democracy to be at its best, that means that the more people that can take part, the better. We should be looking for ways to engage with more people, not less, to make it possible for more people to vote, to be enfranchised, not for less. Mm. And for me, I see technology as a way of enablement. It's not the Holy Grail, but it's a path to achieve, to provide a tool to allow people access where previously they don't necessarily have access. So, for example, if we enabled online voting, now, of course, there are questions about security, but these are not insurmountable questions, not by any stretch of the imagination. Mm. If we enabled online voting, then think about the access that would make possible for members of our community who are housebound.
Mm. Mm, absolutely.
I just see that we are missing the opportunity to involve more people actively in our democracy by not embracing the possibilities that technology offers.
Mm. How do you think technology then could work perhaps in regards to voter ID? Because as you mentioned there, obviously something that if you were to introduce online voting would be to ensure that there wasn't any tampering in elections or in the way that people voted. Do you think that that's something that potentially could be made as an argument for or against the government's plans regarding voter ID? What are your thoughts on that?
I have to say I'm highly suspicious about the government's plans for introducing voter ID. In fact, we uh, the Liberal Democrat group had a motion about it at the last Gloucestershire County Council meeting because of our concern. In fact, it seems to me that it is a backdoor approach to disenfranchising members of our community. There are plenty of reports, plenty of research, plenty of statistics to support the fact that it tends to be members of our community who live in more vulnerable circumstances, who have more challenges, who do not fit the white middle class, fully employed demographic, who may have more difficulty accessing appropriate ID that would allow them to vote in the all-new regime that is being outlined by the Tory proposals. And we know also that it is those self-same, perhaps more vulnerable or more challenged or less white, middle-class, fully employed members of the community who are less likely to vote Tory. And I just see that as a way of the Conservatives trying to shore up their vote and ensure that there are less votes for other parties, which I don't believe is the way that the country should be going.
Mm. Do you think, because there have been suggestions that the voter ID legislation is in part inspired by voter ID registration that's been seen in America and in Republican states, where Republicans have been trying to introduce much harsher voter ID systems. Do you think then that this is another example of the so-called culture war, of an attempt to create an issue where perhaps there wasn't an issue, and in order to stoke divisions between different groups by particular political parties, in this case perhaps the Conservatives, in the US perhaps the Republicans?
I do think that a lot of the issues, so-called issues, that the Conservatives seem to be coming out with currently are almost straight out of the Trump playbook, if you like. That they are doing exactly that. They are trying to play culture wars and stoke outrage about things that you know people aren't actually outraged by, or that aren't actually issues. I mean, you know, if you look at the statistics, voter fraud is in infinitesimal statistics. You know, 0.00001% or something like that, according to the Electoral Commission, of identified voter fraud in the last, a statistically significant issue. Yet you listen to conservative ministers, and apparently it's everybody in the neighbour is down the street and trying to nick your vote. It's a way of distraction. I think it's sort of I can't remember who it was. The phrase opium for the masses. You know, that might have been Lenin, possibly. Wouldn't be a very conservative quote to use, but the concept of distraction. You know, you use this bright shiny thing to distract people from what's really going on. What's really going on is our NHS is horrifically underfunded and on its knees. You know, this latest suggestion that, NHS staff, well, they're going to have a 3% pay rise, but it's got to be from current budgets. Current budgets don't actually already cover the requirements that they already have. Mm. It's fully well known that if the pay rise has to come from the current budget, that means further slashing of services. It's an insidious way of running the NHS down. But if people are being distracted by some other terrible issue that's going on that's not really an issue, then they won't notice what's going on in this corner. It's like a magician's sleight of hand.
Absolutely. One of the key issues that has been talked about a great deal recently, featured in the Chesham and Amersham by-election, has featured across the country in local elections and elections in recent years, has of course been housing. What do you see as the Liberal Democrats' main focus in terms of housing?
I think the important thing, I mean, honestly, I'm not entirely sure what the national position is. I know that our position locally and across the Cotswolds is what we need is more affordable housing. Mm-hmm. What we need is more socially rented housing. What we need is housing that is accessible for young people, for families, at a price and at a way of accessibility for somebody's life stage that is currently in very short supply. So at the moment, in Cirencester, for example, we've got a real problem with young people staying in the town. Now, I mean, maybe one reason is that we don't have a massive amount of nightlife, although that's less of an issue during pandemic times, perhaps. But another issue is that rental properties are really expensive. So for a young person, either single or in a couple, getting their first flat, it's really hard work, you know, getting the deposit together to put down to rent somewhere and then finding the money to pay every month. Finding the money to pay every month. Perhaps when they're on their first job after college or after university, you know, that's really demanding. We don't have a suitable range of property available to allow your average young person to leave school or leave college and be able to move out and get their own place. Similarly, it's really hard for families to move from their starter property to a slightly bigger place, you know, when they've kind of got one child and they're, you know, maybe they're expecting another one, or you know they need a little bit more space because property prices are absolutely crazy. And you know, I fully understand that housing is a market, and for some people, having a proper property portfolio is their career. However, houses shouldn't ever just be seen as an investment or as an industry. They are, you know, part of the lifeblood of our communities. And I think it's imperative for us as local councils and as councillors to facilitate the lifeblood of our communities. And that means having somewhere for our residents to live. So that means mixed opportunity housing, rental and purchase at different price points that are, you know, suitable for different stages in the life cycle of life.
Absolutely. We're coming towards the end of the podcast, Rebecca. It's been great to have you on, and I have one final question. And now, we've touched upon the pandemic a little bit, and things seem to be somewhat getting better with the rollout of the vaccination and falling COVID cases at the moment. However, of course, things aren't fully back to normal. And when things are fully back to normal, which will hopefully be soon, what one thing that you haven't been able to do are you most looking forward to being able to do again?
Crumbs. do you know, I think I've been really fortunate during the course of this whole strange period, because you know, I'm not used to living a very glamorous lifestyle. Actually, you know, I don't travel extensively. You know, I don't eat out all the time. So, you know, my lifestyle per se wasn't hideously impacted. You know, from the start of first lockdown. You know, I have my children, and we hang out together a lot anyway. So we've carried on doing that. We've done a lot more sort of walking and things like that, which has been great. So we haven't, you know, most importantly, we haven't lost anybody really close to us. So we've been incredibly blessed. I guess the thing that we're all looking forward to most is being able to see people that we care about. You know, it's been very hard to see family members. We've only seen the kids' grandparents once in the last year, that's tough. And you know, being able to just kind of go off and go somewhere different has obviously been a challenge. So I think just having the freedom to be able to plan to go and do something will be nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not going to be flying off to the other side of the world, because we weren't doing that anyway.
Well, hopefully you will be able to visit people and to be able to plan things better in the near future. Rebecca, if people want to find out more about you and your work as a counsellor, where should they go to work to find out more about you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Rebecca Halifax, or my counsellor page is on Facebook, Councillor Rebecca Halifax. So I'm relatively easy to find. The counsellor page on Facebook is where I tend to post what I'm up to, and my Twitter feed is a mixture of politics and current affairs and talking about books and sort of ranting about life in general.
Fantastic. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter at Debated Podcast. Like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.